This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence.
Hello, and welcome to the summer special episode of The Human and the Machine from Editorial Intelligence, where we coincide with the end of lockdown, or nearly the end of lockdown, and the beginning of a glimpse of normality after months of a very unnormal life, with a look at the one piece of technology which has arguably defined the spring and summer of 2020 the world over, Zoom. I'm Wendell Stevenson. In my normal life, I usually travel a lot. After spending most of the post 9/11 decade in the Middle East, covering wars and revolutions, I now write about food for the Financial Times and others, and novels. But for the past few weeks, like nearly all of us, I have been at home, and my big wide world has been the internet. I will be guest presenting this episode. Here's a snapshot of what is coming up.
I actually find the lines between social and work life get very much blurred. And for me, I think it's actually about how to humanize the business side of the equation that needs a lot of work.
One of the things we have to be really aware of is that at the moment we are trying to use Zoom as a substitute or a replacer for real-world interaction. Certainly that rings true with my own experience and also with the literature that I've consumed. It just doesn't function in the same way as real-world interaction with each other.
That was Rima Perelmutter and Jet Sanders, who are among the guests joining me to look at video conferencing in the time of Corona. I'm also going to be talking to Liz Mosley of Tortoise Media about how they have pivoted to online engagement with their readers. And we will be hearing a tech take from the great cyber king and thinker, Charles Arthur. I had never heard of Zoom before lockdown. Now it's a verb like Google. According to the most recent Ofcom report at the beginning of the year, Zoom had a little over 600,000 subscribers in the UK. By the end of April, that figure was 13 million. Video conferencing has begun to challenge text and email and the old audio phone call as our means of communication. In lockdown, Zoom replaced classrooms and offices. It became a way for people to gather in memoriam, a way for musicians to play a virtual concert, and for people to stay in touch with their loved ones in hospital. But there's a big difference, I find, between a one-on-one conversation and staring at a screen of 20 squares with 20 faces. We've all experienced, I think, what's becoming known as Zoom fatigue, the blurriness, the freeze frames. So I'm asking, is Zoom better for some things than others? Maybe it's good for conveying information, not so great in encouraging those kinds of spontaneous interruptions that spark friendship or creativity or a new idea. Is Zoom a brilliant tool that will make the office redundant, get rid of commutes, and allow us all to spend more time at home? Or will it just replace the mass email as the new, most annoying work innovation ever? So this episode, I'm joined by Jet Sanders, an assistant professor in behavioral science at the London School of Economics, who has done a lot of fascinating research on how people work, how they interact with and take cues from their physical surroundings, and also crucially how faces help people form first impressions. And I'm also joined by Rima Perelmutter, who has been working on the relationship between people and technology for over 20 years, first in mobile phone ecosystems, and more recently for Datum Future, a think tank looking at how to navigate the new world of data. She's really interested in issues around trust in the digital world. So let me ask you, Jet, first, about your experiences during lockdown and how you've managed Zoom.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I'm a lecturer, I'm a researcher, so I have two types of meetings. One is mostly with people who I'm doing research with. So sometimes those are people that are much more senior than I am, and sometimes those are people that are more junior than I am. And then I also teach a lot. So that's sort of in small groups or in larger groups. And in my experience, large groups works really well if there's a very clear hierarchy. If there's a very clear role assigned to each person being in the room, so student lecturer, for example, I think that works a charm. If the hierarchy is not very well established, I think it's much more difficult to know who gets to speak at what time. I think it's much more common, and I think people recognize this also from social meetings, which is something that I've started at and then quit very, very quickly because I wasn't enjoying it at all, to try and have meetings with friends as well. And I think partially that's because of the lack of hierarchy. So everyone's trying to be interested in everyone else. There's no nonverbal cues helping you direct where your attention should be going. So people keep talking through each other. And I think that happens a lot in non-hierarchical settings where it's not clear who should be taking the lead.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Rima, how has lockdown been for you? Have you been online a lot? And have you noticed that organizing that Zoom conference is of paramount importance to its success?
Yes, I think we've all been online a lot in the past few months. This has been an amazing enabler and equalizer in many ways. So I've worked in tech for 20 years, and I've always been amazed by how much progress we've made. And I think that's been really poignant during this time. The Zoom video conferencing and other technologies has allowed us to connect in a way we never would have had this technology not been around. But I think it really requires human intervention to ensure that people can use it wisely and meaningfully. So I've had my own personal experience of managing it in my life recently around a circumstance that arose I didn't plan for, but I found myself having to put together an online memorial for my mother, who caught COVID in her care home in Paris and passed away within 9 days in April. And obviously, I couldn't travel to Paris, but I felt a calling to do something really meaningfully in a way that would really celebrate her life. And I knew I had to get creative and personal. That became very apparent to me. I basically spent 2 weeks curating meaningful content that I thought would really connect to her family and friends. We wound up having a 2-hour celebration that brought together 25 friends across 7 different cities and 4 different time zones. This really shows the power of what good video conferencing and carefully thought through kind of engagement can deliver. So it's actually an incredibly cathartic experience that obviously would have never happened in a pre-COVID moment that I was really proud of, and something that taught me a few lessons about the importance of making it much more human and ensuring that you have the right visual audio cues that people can really connect to.
Rima, I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm so glad that coming together in this way was cathartic and helpful. And I'm really impressed by the idea that Zoom, even in these kind of circumstances, can actually maybe even bring more people together and be relatively more inclusive than in real life might have been, because you were able to collect people from all over the world who might not have been able to travel to a memorial service. So I'm interested to understand, too, how Zoom can be used for social interactions as well as for slightly more hierarchical, curated, or organized professional ones. What do you think, Jet?
I would actually recommend to have a spatial separation of those two things. So I think it can be used for both, if that's the form of your choice. But I think one of the issues that people are finding is using Zoom as a portal for everything. So one of the things that you can do, you can try to do, is separate those two things out to reduce Zoom fatigue, is to say, for example, if you're in meetings for work, you have a specific background, let's say a very plain one, a simple one, which signals that you're in your office. And when you're in a social meeting, you might have either no background at all, or you might have a background of a palm tree, which signals that you are in your social, in your private time. In the same way, you can think about where you might be using your laptop in a specific space. Turn off view of self, so you're not actually just looking at your own mirror image all the time, which is very distracting for most people. Try not to do other things at the same time, which I think people also tend to find difficult. And then the final thing I'll say is for a personal use of Zoom, I actually think it works very well to actually not be paying attention to the screen very much. So to use it in a social setup, in a social format, in a social space. Although, of course, that depends on the content that you're covering. So I think the example Rima just gave obviously requires a lot of attention, but you can also see Zoom as a portal into another world that can connect you. So you can sort of cook together or do sports together. And then it's really just an extension of your living room as opposed to something you're meant to be paying attention through, which I found to be very useful.
Listening to Rima and Jet made me realize how important it is to pay attention to the human stuff, the automatic cues with which we show respect and care for the person we're talking to face to face needs to be more carefully narrated or curated online. Whenever I want to understand the wider experience of a new technology, I do what most people do. I ask my younger, more tech-savvy brother. Michael Stevenson, the middle child, is a public relations executive who works with a lot of tech brands, and he's been working at home with three kids throughout lockdown. He lives in New York, in Queens, a neighborhood at the epicenter of the coronavirus that has also been the scene of protests during the Black Lives Matter movement. He told me about an extraordinary online meeting that changed the way I thought about the limitations of Zoom.
This is the human and the machine.
You know, the business world has reacted in a number of different ways to the current unrest and the Black Lives Matter protests across the country. Current events have initiated much, much bigger organizational conversations. So earlier in the week, my office had an all-staff call, which I think the entire office dialed into, which is, you know, 130, 140 odd people. But then yesterday, my company hosted a company-wide call. So the purpose of the call was basically to have an open house and provide a kind of an open forum for people within the company worldwide, especially people of color, to talk about their own personal stories of the events of the last week. So you had some very raw, very emotional commentary happening, which normally, I mean, that's a scary enough position to be in at the best of times. Now do that in front of a crowd of 700 people, and that can become quite terrifying. I mean, prohibitively so for some. And I didn't speak, but, you know, I did think about speaking. But I think getting up in front of a room of 700 people and having that kind of conversation would have been sort of terrifying for most people. But somehow doing it through a video conference call immediately makes it a sort of a more intimate environment because you can only see 25 faces staring back at you. So it has an advantage over a conference call because you can see people's faces. You can see that kind of the immediate impact that what you're saying is having on people from a sort of an emotional level. But it's a safer environment than being in person because you're not presented with a room full of 700 people, you know, to the point where it sort of really does get quite terrifying. So I sort of found that a uniquely well-suited environment to host and hold such an important conversation with such a large number of people. It's also the sort of the great equalizer because nobody has pole position. No, you know, no one person is standing on a stage or at the front of the room. Everybody is represented by their 2-inch by 2-inch box on the screen. No one has kind of physical position over anybody else. You know, and when you have the floor, you know, you have it in exactly the same way that everybody else does.
Technology is brilliant at some things, terrible at others. Throughout this summer special, we'll bring you some voices from the editorial intelligence network of movers, shakers, thinkers, doers, and what their personal techno heaven or hell is.
Techno heaven. Techno hell.
Hello, my name is Ryan Nile, and I am the host of the Ryan Nile Show podcast. I'm also the producer of Techish, a podcast by two black millennial tech entrepreneurs about the cross-section of technology, pop culture, and current events. My techno heaven would be the internet. The internet has done so much for us and literally created modern life. Now, my techno hell, printers. I hate printers with a passion.
The idea that video conferencing, Zoom, can be a great leveler, a tool that encourages a wider and broader engagement, is a powerful one. I'm joined now by Liz Mosley, editor and partner at Tortoise Media. Tortoise is a new media porthole providing slower, wiser news. Founded just last year, it's become one of my favorite places for intelligent and thoughtful essays and podcasts, reportage and photography. And one of the things they've done, which I think is really interesting, is to engage with their readership by hosting regular, what they call think-ins, inviting people to discussions in their newsroom. In lockdown, they've taken these online. So Liz, how has this gone?
Thank you. Yes, hi, Wendell. It's nice to be here. The think-in, we've always said, is the engine of Tortoise journalism. What is intentionally different about the way we do news at Tortoise is that it is slow and it is open. And by open, we mean it's built around a system of organized listening. So rather than it being a bunch of journalists sitting in a news conference in a newsroom in the morning, it will be us, invited speakers, and our members physically coming into the newsroom to sit with us and nut out a perspective on an emerging story, an old story, or sometimes just an untold story.
So how has it been taking that very real in a room experience online?
Well, we were worried. I was worried. We really, really prized ourselves on creating a welcoming atmosphere. We wanted for a thinking to feel like you were coming into our home. And my assumption was that we just couldn't recreate that online. I'm very happy to say that I was wrong. And if anything, the intimacy and homeliness has more than been replicated online in many ways. There's something about seeing in the little boxes the faces of all the people in their kitchens and back rooms and staff rooms in some cases, that is really rather touching and rather moving and somehow more personal than having people crash in after a day at work, 6:30 with a glass of wine in hand. And certainly because we've been able to reach so many more people, you know, in the 12 months to the middle of March, we'd done 10,000 altogether in a year registrations for think-ins. And in the 3 months to now, since the beginning of lockdown, we've done 25,000, and they're from all over the world. The breadth of people that have joined in has changed dramatically. We always skewed younger at Tortoise. About a third of Tortoise members are under 30. But now we meet far, far more women, far, far more students. We've been able to do really interesting marketing partnerships with people in our Tortoise network, key workers, all kinds of things that we just wouldn't have been able to do if we were restricted to our rather rarefied, fancy Oxford Circus-based newsroom.
So how has the, if they're larger and there are more people, how has the nature of the debate and the discussion changed?
There are far more chances for members to contribute because there's the editor on the screen talking away to the invited guests and bringing people in who put up their little blue digital hand that you have on Zoom. But there's also everybody who joins in the chat function.
Liz found that the chats going on alongside the main visual debate also encouraged people to join in. She said the experience of taking their think-ins with outside speakers and engaging their membership in editorial discussions had been a game changer, driving greater inclusion and a wider audience, and crucially, a bigger subscriptions base.
I'm fascinated at how this encourages engagement and encourages a different kind of conversation and relationship between media and its consumers. It's almost as if you're making consumers part of the content. And yeah. I'm really interested too how you manage to balance the main debate and discussion that's being led and curated by Compares or a panel with this sort of sidebar comment section thread, which is become the literal subtext in real time. Does it diverge? Do you want to keep it? Should it remain as a sort of a bit of ephemera?
I think the chat is so fundamental to the experience. There's a quirk of Zoom, which is the platform that we use,
that if you choose to run your session as a webinar, it's more like a kind of broadcast experience, that you can be an attendee watching the people who are the main event talking on screen, but you're limited in the way that you can interact with them. And if you have fewer than 500 people, in our case, you can run it as a meeting where everybody's camera is on, everybody can private message everybody else, and it's a sort of all pile in scenario. Thinkins work much, much better as a meeting than a webinar because everybody has the opportunity to get hands on. My favourite one was Jess Phillips, the MP for Birmingham Yardley. We tried to get her in the newsroom and she cancelled the first time, I think because she was unwell. Then the second one we had to cancel because she ran for leader of the Labour Party and she was a bit busy that week. And we finally got her and I was thrilled to be the one to host that thinking. She joined the thinking from her bed and she sort of tipped the camera over the edge of the bed to show that on the floor of her bedroom was the domestic abuse bill that she was live amending with a biro, you know, just before. And there was somehow the framing of the conversation, just me sitting here in my lounge and her in her bed, that it felt like a sort of a whole new way to talk to somebody in Parliament. There was an informality to it that was disarming for me as an interviewer, weirdly, but also incredibly inspiring for the people who wanted to come on and talk to Jess. They weren't really asking her policy questions. In fact, we talked a lot about mothers, her mum, her mum's experiences, my mum, who I lost when I was 20. It became a conversation largely between women, to be fair, but it became a conversation about something other than politics. And yet that was grounded in something about a moment of change and how we were going to try to change the power dynamics in our society.
I think it's so interesting how seeing in somebody's home or being invited into somebody's home breaks down a formality and those barriers and creates a sort of intimate connection.
Yeah.
And more informal connection, perhaps even a more human connection between people rather than work or the transaction of interlocution of interviewer and subject.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting dynamic.
Now you're in for a treat. We decided to ask Charles Arthur, one of the world's leading tech journalists and the author of books such as Cyber Wars, Hacks That Shook the Business World, and we asked him to give us a snapshot of a happening tech trend.
I'm sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I'm waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee. They don't sound like the words to trigger a revolution. Yet the Suzanne Vega song Tom's Diner, for which those are the opening lines, shaped the technology that brings you what I'm saying, the MP3. And the MP3 is leading another revolution, getting paid for content which in theory could be copied endlessly and given away for free. In the song, Vega sings a cappella. It's her unaccompanied voice. It was released in 1987, when a man called Karl Heinz Brandenburg was working in Germany on a very special computer algorithm. Brandenburg wanted to shrink digital audio files to a tenth of their original size, so they'd be easier to store and transmit over the internet, yet not lose listening quality. And Vega's was the song he kept returning to check his work. Vega's liquid voice challenged his algorithms like nothing else, because our brains pick out anything odd in a human voice.
We can spot synthesized voices, even though we don't quite know how.
Brandenburg's final compression algorithm could shrink Tom's Diner and other music successfully. It became known as the MP3, but it had no copy protection system. In the late 1990s, people began using it to rip the songs off CDs, turn them into MP3s, and share them on systems like the first Napster. The music business watched in horror as a gigantic free listening party took off. It took years of lawsuits against Napster and successor file sharing systems to shut them down. So when Apple wanted to set up an online music store, record labels were clear about one thing: no MP3s, and copy protection on every song to prevent piracy. More than a decade later, online music is all about streaming. But the streams aren't MP3s. They're wrapped in copy protection software to encrypt the content. If you copy a Spotify music stream, you can only play it in Spotify's app. Instead, the really big use of MP3 for audio nowadays is in podcasts, such as this one. How do they make money? The bigger ones have adverts and sponsors. But as advertisers and sponsors dry up, many smaller podcasters are wondering how to charge listeners money for a podcast. Some companies solve that by locking podcasts inside their own apps. Spotify has poached some big-name podcasters in order to attract people to its platform. But for smaller podcasters, that isn't an option. So how can they get people to pay for an MP3? Now Ben Thompson, who writes the Stratechery blog, has devised what may be a winning solution. To understand it, you need to understand how podcasts reach you. A podcast is an audio file on a website. Subscribing to a podcast means your podcast app bookmarks a specific URL, or web location, where the audio files are stored. The app periodically checks that bookmark for updates. When a new podcast is added there, the app downloads it. Thompson's idea, introduced early in May 2020, is this. You go to his site and sign up to pay a recurring amount. In return, your podcast app is sent a unique, unguessable URL on his site where the podcast files will appear. Only people who pay get a URL, so only they can download the podcast. Sure, you could give all your friends a URL, but that's your money you're losing. And the deceit would quickly be obvious to Thompson, who could block excess downloads via the unique URL. It's a neat idea that at least one other podcast has already adopted. A subscription fee of a few dollars a month, multiplied by enough listeners, could revolutionize podcasting. So yes, you can make money from unprotected MP3s. That's the tech trend. And if you're listening to this in Tom's Diner in New York, try the coffee.
This is the Human and the Machine.
I hope you're enjoying this rich mix of holiday hearing as much as I am. And I hope it's helped to put in perspective that being stuck to headphones instead of being able to chat in bars and restaurants and gyms can be helped if we have good ideas and good people to hear. I'd like to hear a bit more again from Rima and Jet. Zoom is a boon of greater connectivity, but as we discovered with other internet innovations, too much of anything, email, targeted ads, tracking apps, can easily tip into overload. So what are the lessons for the future?
For the business side, I think there is a lot of fatigue that's inevitable for many people who are on calls a lot. And I think there are a couple of things that we can do. So firstly, I think if you are the moderator for a call, I think it's important to recognize that certain people will be extroverts and introverts, just like in real life, and take that into account. So you can use the chat feature to be more inclusive. You can ask people how they're feeling on a certain day. If it's a meeting where people are not turning on the video, then maybe give them the option not to do that, because sometimes having a conversation about your business agenda will go much easier if it's just a phone call, but you originally scheduled it as a Zoom call. And also, I think it's important to be really friendly and personal and open up a conversation wherever possible. That's where the human intervention is so important. And for me, I think this is not going to end anytime soon. I mean, the new normal, it feels like people are going to be working and socializing remotely for the near future. And we need to adapt our habits maybe and think about how to manage those downsides that Jet explained so eloquently.
How is this going to reshape the world of work, and how is the balance or the new balance between office and home life going to shake down? Jet?
One of the things we have to be really aware of is that at the moment we are trying to use Zoom as a substitute or a replacer for real world interaction. And I think as Rima described, certainly that rings true with my own experience and also with the literature that I've consumed, is that it just doesn't function in the same way as real-world interaction with each other. You have to be aware of the things that are missing from interactions like that, especially if this is going to be something that we're taking forward. I think the best online interactions I've had are with people that have shown awareness that you are just not going to able to transmit all the same information that you would be face-to-face, and that show an awareness in compensating for that. So for example, one of the things that I've really started to pay attention to is to narrate things that I would usually do with my eye movement. So usually if you're paying attention to a slide and I am turning my head in a way, then my students can see what I'm paying attention to. When my eye gaze shifts in a Zoom meeting, they have no idea what I am paying attention to. And that's actually really distracting and confusing unless I narrate that. I think that can be really helpful for students. And it's obviously not just for students. In any form of interaction, you can do that. You can make sure that you are compensating for that. And that can become habitual. Before you know it, you're moving your mouse in exchange or in concordance with your eye movements to make sure that everyone else on the meeting can also see that.
Thank you, Jet. Thank you, Rima. There's a lot to think about. Costs, benefits, new ways of communicating, new ways of connecting. I think we're all going to learn to be better broadcasters. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Every time there has been a communications innovation, from printing to texting, we have learned new ways to accommodate to the new environment. Just like hello was popularized to begin a conversation on a telephone by testing the line at the same time as issuing a greeting, I'm sure we will develop a new grammar, a new language, new etiquettes for Zoom, because adaptation, evolution, even in the age of the digital machine, it's what we humans are good at. Let's leave you with some techno heavens and techno hells from today's guests and some other Editorial Intelligence Network voices. And if you'd like to find out more about Editorial Intelligence and to sign up for the newsletter and the show notes, head straight for www.editorialintelligence.com.
I'm Liz Mosley. I am an editor and partner at Tortoise Media. And my techno heaven is hair straighteners that turn themselves off. And my techno hell is patchy Wi-Fi.
Hi, I'm Rima Perelmutter. I'm Executive Director of Datum Future. My techno heaven is my online yoga class. And my techno hell is people speaking over each other on Zoom.
My name is Jet Sanders. I am an assistant professor in behavioral science at the London School of Economics and Political Sciences. And my techno hell are GP automated messages that last longer than a minute.
Hello, my name's Katie Huey, and I'm a strategist. My techno heaven is Babylon's GP at Hand app. It's basically a replacement for a physical GP. You use the app on your smartphone, and they use AI to help you with some of your symptoms. And if you are very worried, you can then speak to a nurse or a doctor. I found it incredibly reassuring, especially given the past few months of lockdown and COVID. And it's just an amazing user experience and a way of managing your health if you are digitally savvy and young and don't mind looking at your doctor or a nurse through a phone screen. So yeah, GP at Hand is my techno heaven.
Hello, and my name is Henry Mason, and I think deeply about consumer trends and the meaningful innovation opportunities that they present to businesses. So my tech heaven is also my tech hell. Amazon Alexa, of course. On the one hand, sitting on the sofa, turning on and off the side lights to create the right atmosphere, lying in bed, just saying, Alexa, good night, and the lights turning off, you're living in the future. Effortless future where the world bends to your will as you express it. But also the hell, has it ever felt more emasculating? That little blue light spins round and round while it deigns whether or not to grant your wish, the sense of shame as you ask again, and then mentally calculate how many times you have to ask before it would have just been quicker to get up and flick the switch yourself. Is there a gadget that better encapsulates our conflicted relationship with technology? On the one hand, you feel like a god. 2 minutes later, when Alexa randomly blurts out a nonsensical interruption, you feel like a fool.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Like I said, for show notes and to stay connected to Editorial Intelligence, including the back catalogue of episodes in the first two series of The Human and Machine, head to editorialintelligence.com. This program was presented by me, Wendell Stevenson, was executive produced by Julia Hobsbawm, and was edited by George McDonough for Editorial Intelligence. Thanks to all my guests, and thank you for listening.